Welcome, gentle listeners, to the Daily Nightly, a Jane Austen journey, where we'll be reading the collective works of Jane Austen and exploring her influence in pop culture. We are your humble servants. I'm Annie.
And I'm Jessie.
And today we are talking about chapters 6 through 10 of Jane Austen's Mansfield Park. I don't know why I always have to say that, like I'm introducing a pro wrestler or something, but it feels right.
I like it. For some reason, it really works with Mansfield Park. Like a cross between Let's Get Ready to Rumble and the way Oprah introduces people.
Honestly, I don't know why we haven't gotten a pro wrestling Jane Austen adaptation.
Oh my God. I mean, we could workshop it right now. It could totally work.
Oh, do you want like WWE type wrestlers? Or do you want like the Luchador type? Ooh, actually, that's really interesting. Anyways.
But anyway.
Just everyone put a pin in that. And if you come up with anything, we would like to be
credited
in the acknowledgements. Yeah. Yes. We don't need to be in alphabetical order. If you really feel like you love Jessie more, that's okay. I understand.
Annie came up with it, so her name should be first. I'm fine.
I just want my name in print. Anyways, before we get into Mansfield Park, Jessie, what have you been reading lately?
Yeah, so I'm going to talk about two different things that I've been reading. The first is to remind you that I'm actually a very smart person that reads smart books, because the second is different. Anyway, so since we last spoke, I read Ijeoma Oluo's new book, Mediocre, The Dangerous Legacy of White Male America. It's essentially a history of white male America and goes into, to quote the summary, what it has cost us socially, economically, and politically. It's a really compelling read. I have about 100 highlights in it. I mention it because I really think it should be required reading generally, but also in light of the recent events here in America, I think it's absolutely necessary to help people that were saying, this is not us, really contextualize how, yes, it is, and here's all the reasons why. I love her writing. She wrote a book. What is it? How to talk? Oh my God! I'm sorry.
So you want to talk about race?
Yes, that was her. Sorry, I was like, how you want to talk about anything? But yeah, so her books are really, really, really good, and I recommend them. In addition to that, I also became slightly obsessed with something the YA Book Talk and Bookstagram communities are already obsessed with: the A Court of Thorns and Roses series by Sarah J. Maas. The series is three books and a novella, and Maas has another book in the universe that's coming out next month in February, focused on different characters, but in the same universe. Let me preface this by saying these books are not well written. There are a lot of writing issues, there are plotting issues, and representation issues. However, having said that, I enjoyed the heck out of them. These books center on Farah, a human who's providing for her two sisters and her father, and while hunting one winter, inadvertently murders a fairy and is taken into a magical kingdom and held captive. Some of this story might sound familiar, and there's a lot of Beauty and the Beast in the first book, but the second book in the series, A Court of Mist and Fury, makes a sharp left turn and does some actually pretty good stuff to interrogate the fantasy story, but mostly it just gives me one of the best love interests that I've ever read in a book, and I can't stop thinking about them. I know there are a lot of issues, and you're going to be totally fed up by some of the things that Maas uses in her stories over and over again, like calling people males and females, which I get. I mean, they're not humans, men and women, but still, she says it a lot. People call each other their mate a lot. People make vulgar gestures a lot. People purr a lot. But it's just like really compelling. I don't think she's ever taken a class on story structure, but at the same time, it's just like thing after thing after thing. It's very much in the vein of like female protagonist like ends up in wild situation and has to use her ingenuity to figure her way out. There's love triangle. It'll sound very familiar to you if you grew up at all in the 2000s and read any book in 2004 or 5. But I just, you know, it's like junk. It's like a book junk food, and I just like ate it all up. So if you just want like a fun escapism type fantasy with some sex scenes in there, then check out this book series. I don't know if I sold it or not.
I think sometimes you need some good junk food in life. And when I was younger, I used to hear these kind of things and think, ugh, who lets these people publish books? And now it's weirdly inspiring. Like, wow, it's not that hard sometimes. Maybe I should just give it a go and see if I could have a side gig.
You might. Yeah, you should totally give it a go. But yeah, I read all of them in like a matter of days. And they're like 800 page books because she is like no editor. Oh, I think it's a really good love interest. I was very into it. So you don't meet him until book two, really. So anyway, before I spoil.
I assume there's something really actually genuinely good in it too for you to for it to capture your attention like that.
Yeah, yeah, it's a really easy to get into series, and the fan community is really cool. Like if you look up ACOTAR, as it's like abbreviated on like Tumblr or Instagram, the art in this community and the writing, the fan art and fanfic is just phenomenal. So it's a good fan community mostly.
I do like good fan communities.
Mm-hmm. But anyway, I could go on the series way too long. So Annie, what are you consuming or reading lately?
Oh gosh. Okay, so I think the last time we talked, I started and finished The Song of Achilles by, what's her name, Madeline Miller, which I know I'm kind of late to that train on, but it was, you know, it was kind of worth the wait. It was unsurprisingly to no one, since I think everyone else has read it. It's a beautiful, epic, tragic, heartbreaking, romantic, I don't know, fascinating retelling of an ancient story that I already knew I loved. So that was great. I was promised crying. I did not cry, I will say, but I definitely felt a lot of things on a deep level. It actually reminded me of being in college when I read the Iliad for school.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Well, because it was around the time that the movie Troy came out, and we were all really excited because it was coming out, I think, over winter break. And when we all came back, all of us were like, eh, not gay enough. So
it's true.
It helped, you know, it helped fill in that missing space in my soul that was left behind by Brad Pitt, I guess, and Garrett Hedlund. So that was really good. And I started reading Stephen Fry's book Mythos, which is just a whole bunch of Greek mythology being told in that sort of way that Stephen Fry has. He reads the audiobook as well, and he's just got a lovely voice. He has that very like eloquent way he has of speaking, where, you know, he has this incredible vocabulary and usage of words, but it's also still very conversational and personal, which I think really fits the whole oral tradition of these sort of stories. So that's fun. That one I'm not going to finish for a while because it's such a massive book and I'm doing it the audiobook. What else am I reading? The Lady's Guide to Petticoats and Piracy by Mackenzie Lee. It's the second book in the Montague siblings. I don't know if it's a trilogy or just a series in general. Well, there's only three siblings, so it is the sequel to The Gentleman's Guide to Vice and Virtue, which I think I read about a year and a half ago. And that was something which I just thought would be like a fun kind of like two boys in Georgian England figure out that they're actually in love and then have adventures. But it turned out to be this kind of supernatural conspiracy with pirates.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I think I bought the first one.
It's a lot of fun and I really enjoyed it. This one is about his sister who may be kind of on the neurodivergent spectrum and is also just fantastic character. And she wants to be a surgeon in a time when women, you know, they couldn't possibly be led to a medical school because they're not built for it, blah, blah, blah. Mm. So it's a lot of fun. Really interested, you know, more pirates, more lady surgeons, more going off on adventures, and who knows? I genuinely expect to be surprised by the whole thing. I also read one of her other books last year, I think, Loki, Where Mischief Lies, which was like a YA prequel to the MCU Loki story.
Oh.
She's got a range of things that applies to, weirdly, a lot of my interests. But, I mean, we can't really talk about pop culture and other things we're taking in right now, of course, without mentioning Bridgerton.
Yes.
Which comes up at work almost daily since Christmas.
It is. Yeah, every single person I know is watching it or has watched it and is entranced by it. And I've had to explain romance novels to a lot of those people. One of my friends was like, where is like the real conflict? It's just like interpersonal stuff. I was like, yeah, it's a romance novel. Like, of course, the conflict is nonsense.
All the best conflict is interpersonal.
That's true. But it's a Netflix show. I think Shonda Rhimes, it's like her production company. I'm not sure how much direct influence she had on it. But it's based on the first season is based on the first book by Julia Quinn and the Bridgerton siblings series. The first is called The Duke and I. And each Bridgerton sibling gets a book. I think it's already been renewed for a second season. I'm almost positive it will be because everyone is watching it.
It's captured like so many people's attentions. The rhetoric about, around it has been really interesting. So many people, you know, I've seen so many videos on YouTube pop up about the costumes. I've seen discussion one on a lot of people saying that it's basically like what Americans think England was like at the time, as opposed to what it actually was like, which is funny because it seems true.
Yeah.
And obviously like race discussion on the fact, you know, it appears to be racially blind casting, but then they actually refer to it at some point in the show. So it's a little messy, but oh, it's so good.
Yeah, there's a lot to really like about it, especially if you're an Austen fan. It basically takes place in the same time as the books that we're reading, as like the 1800s England. But these are more like city parties, like the town and London. I think Austen covers London, but it's more like the country courting versus the town.
That word just for some reason kept confusing me to actually be heard said aloud.
I know. I've only seen it like in italics, like in my books.
It was so weird. But no, what a delightful, fun show. I just keep saying it's kind of like not quite junk food, but it's not junk food.
Mm-hmm. It's like a delight for your eyes. Like every episode is a different party and they're just like lush with the costumes, like you mentioned, and the music. A lot of the music are orchestral covers of mm-hmm. more modern songs. Like
a lot of Vitamin String Quartet, I think.
Yeah, it's like Thank You Next. They do a waltz to it. It's delightful like that. So if you like Austen, you should definitely check it out.
If you like soaps, check it out.
I will say that there is a lot of controversy in the way, like the books were written about 20 years ago. And so I think the books got away with a little bit more than the show, especially because I don't think they handled certain storylines very well.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to be spoiled, like skip ahead a little bit. But there is a scene, I think it's in episode 6.
Yeah.
Where Daphne, the main like female protagonist, is already married to the Duke and she essentially rapes him.
It's questionably, the consent is very questionable.
Yeah, yeah.
To put it incredibly lightly.
Mm-hmm. And I recommend reading maybe about it before you go into it. There's like much better, maybe we'll link to a couple articles that go into a lot of the issues around it. And it did sort of sour the rest of the series for me, to be completely honest. I did really like the finale and the first like 4 episodes are fantastic. So just something to be aware of going in, I think, a content warning.
Certainly.
And I'm almost done with the first book, and it's a little bit different, but like the same sort of thing. I've heard the other books are better.
Yeah, I heard that too. Like this one's actually the weakest of the series.
Yeah, the second book is about Anthony, the oldest brother, and he's like very much doesn't want to fall in love. And then, of course, like meets the woman that changes him. So,
Are you telling me that stick in the mud is somehow going to be more interesting than his sister?
You know, I haven't read the book yet, so I can't vouch for it. But apparently, okay. You know, allegedly.
Every time someone's just like, oh, Lord, I can't believe you guys are still talking about it. And I just like pull out my phone and pull up a picture of like Rege Jean Page. And I'm like, but this man here is our hero. So
he's very handsome. Everyone is very handsome and attractive.
Everyone is incredibly handsome.
It's
almost a problem.
I can't believe we haven't met. It's basically like Gossip Girl in Regency era. So that's
yes.
So Julie Andrews like narrates it.
It took about 3 episodes for me to be like, she sounds so much like Julie Andrews, but not enough like Julie Andrews. And it can't be Julie Andrews, right? And no, sure enough, there she was.
She's having a ton of fun in it, you can tell.
Oh my God, I am so glad that they remember that she's actually not just incredibly posh lady who plays queens and things.
So check it out. Be part of the conversation.
I've watched it all in 2 days, so which was, for me, incredibly fast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really easy to binge.
Speaking of, oh my gosh, all the soap opera shenanigans of Regency era.
Good segue.
You know what? It wasn't even that hard this time because Bridgerton really was right there. We were talking about this earlier before we started recording. These chapters were... They were a lot. And I know we say that like every week. These ones, they really required some work, which almost didn't seem worth it, but then it was.
Yeah, it was a lot more dense. Like at one point, there was just like a one giant page paragraph of like describing the grounds of this guy's house. And my eyes like glazed over. I was like, I don't want to read this. What is this?
Well, because remember, you know, in Pride and Prejudice, we got something like that about Pemberley, but it's much, much, much later in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And that's such a key moment because that's Elizabeth, you know, with fresh eyes, taking in who the person that Darcy was, but in like geographical form, I guess. So it was very meaningful. Here, it was just like tedious and
Yeah, I do think there are some metaphors like buried in there, but we do get a lot of it.
Yeah, there are definitely some moments where, and we'll get to them, where I'm like, I don't think we're talking about the key anymore.
Yeah, the key.
And a lot of these chapters, they seem to be longer and more in-depth than we're used to from Sense and Sensibility and Pride and Prejudice as well. Oh, it's so much. But before we continue on with 6 through 10, if you're anything like me, you had to go back and remind yourself what happened in 1 through 5. So Jesse, why don't you hit us with that?
This was a little hard to distill. I had to like extensively look at our summary from last episode, but I think I did okay. We begin our tale with the young Maria Ward being swept off her feet and married to the rich and titled Sir Thomas Bertram. Maria has two other sisters, Mrs. Norris, who married the Reverend of Sir Thomas Bertram's parish at Mansfield Park. And they have not heard from their other sister for several years before she sends them a letter begging for help and getting her many children placed in the world. Not thinking it entirely through, they send for the eldest daughter, Fanny Price. The Bertrams already have 4 children, 2 older brothers, Thomas and Edmund, and then the 2 younger sisters, Maria and Julia. Fanny is shy and doesn't fit in well with her new siblings, and one day Edmund finds her crying and decides to help her. Fanny manages to survive another 5 years at Mansfield Park before changes arise. Edmund is supposed to take Mrs. Norris's dead husband's spot as a member of the clergy for Mansfield, but because of the debts that Sir Thomas has acquired, the post goes to a Mr. Grant, who moves in along with his wife, Mrs. Grant. Sir Thomas takes the younger and more derelict son with him back to inn to check in on some of their holdings, although younger Sir Thomas eventually does come back to Mansfield. The family flourishes without their patriarch, and it is time for the young Miss Bertrams to be paired off. Maria becomes engaged to the rich yet boring Mr. Rushfield. Newcomers again come to Mansfield. This time they take the form of the brother and sister of Mrs. Grant, Henry and Mary Crawford. The Crawfords are charming and delight the Bertram clan, other than Fanny, who is a puzzle to the Crawfords, and, to be honest, the reader, who don't quite know how Fanny fits into everything. Okay, so how did I do? Is that okay?
You know what? I think you did a million times better than I would have.
Okay. That's fair. You had the harder task, though. You had to distill the entire summary. It was like 50 pages or something.
Oh, my God. Yeah. I tried really hard, and at some point, I'm like, oh, I'm doing so good. But at the same time, wait, so much more happened. Okay. Okay. Okay.
Okay. Okay. Are you ready?
No, I'm not. But we're going to do it anyways, which is my general philosophy of life.
Fair.
Okay. So we meet Mr. Rushworth, who visits Mansfield for the first time, proving to all of us readers that he is not actually offensive, though maybe offensively boring and incapable of having any original thought of his own. Maria Bertram finds him much more interesting, though, when he talks endlessly of his property, Southerton Court, and the renovations he hopes to do with them. Meanwhile, Mary Crawford expected to have a much more boring time with Tom Bertram away and only Edmund around, but it doesn't take long before he starts looking her way. He finds her very beautiful and wanting to hear her play her harp, which is his favorite instrument, and Mary Crawford starts to find him, well, rather pleasant, really, because he's just a lovely man, even if he isn't the most boisterous or charming or exciting of characters. Despite the small red flag when she spoke of her uncle, the Admiral, Edmund starts paying a lot more attention to her, even letting her borrow the mare he acquired for Fanny to teach her how to ride and taking up more and more of her time. Mary is apologetic enough, but it still leaves a bad taste in my mouth. When Edmund starts to scold his aunt and mother for mistreating Fanny one day and making her work in terrible conditions that make her feel unwell, he at least has the decency, though, to recognize his own mistake and be repentant of it. It's, you know, something. Despite Mrs. Norris conniving to get herself, her nieces, and the Crawfords an invite to Southerton Court without Fanny, Edmund makes sure Fanny is invited as well, knowing fully well she really wished to see the grounds. He even offers to stay in Fanny's place so she could go, but Mrs. Grant, being a lovely woman, offers to stay with Lady Bertram instead of Fanny. Somewhere out there, Dr. Grant is probably also really happy to have ruined something of Mrs. Norris's plans. On the way to Southerton, a sibling rivalry develops between the 2 Bertram sisters, who are normally so close, when Julia gets to ride with Henry up front, laughing and flirting and enjoying the whole ride there. It's all fine, of course, once they arrive to Southerton and Mariah can start bragging about all the wealth and land she'll come into when she marries Rushworth. After a tour of the house where we learn how different Mary and Fanny's attitudes about morality and religion are, and Mary learns with shock and horror that Edmund plans to be a clergyman, everyone sets out to see the grounds. Fanny, Edmund, and Mary go for a walk until Fanny is so tired, Edmund insists she stop and rest, while he and Mary keep going for a bit on their own. After some time passes, she is joined not by Edmund and Mary again, but the other trio of Henry, Mariah, and Rushworth. And a flurry of love triangles overlap. It's very confusing. When Rushworth disappears to go get a key, Henry and Mariah go off on a walk together alone themselves. After he assures her that he doesn't like her sister that much, then Julia appears out of nowhere, not wanting to leave him alone. When Rushworth reappears, it's clear he knows he might not be real competition for Henry. And all the while, Fanny just keeps getting abandoned. She, though, goes off to find Edmund and Mary, and it's really clear that she's starting to feel something for him, especially once she realizes that the two of them have completely forgotten about her, getting so lost in each other on their walk. They've been gone like an hour. It's a thing. They all have dinner at the house that night, and Henry keeps playing with the sisters, having Julia sit with him once again on the ride back home. And once Mrs. Norris brags about all the gifts she received at Southerton and demands gratitude from Fanny for allowing her to come because she's the biggest hypocrite in the world, they all finish the ride home in silence. Oh my goodness.
Ooh, that was good.
Thank you. So the whole point of summaries is just to, like, summarize. It was so hard not to keep throwing more details in because there were a lot of details.
Yeah, and I think in first read, it's sort of confusing as to, like, where all this is going. I don't know how you felt. I found myself sort of annoyed.
Mm-hmm.
I know that Fanny is our protagonist, and I want to root for her, but sometimes she makes it really hard because she's so passive, which I don't even know if that's fair or not, if I'm just reading her from my more modern sensibility. I don't know. What are your thoughts on it?
Yeah, no, that's something I wanted to talk to you about with, too. I just wanted to check in of, like, how we feel about her as our protagonist. Because I don't think it's unusual for your main female character in a Jane Austen story to be more passive and things kind of happening to her. It's something that we've discussed before, I think. But there's something about Fanny that is just, I don't know, I don't want to call her demure. I don't want to say that she's, like, more passive or something, but she doesn't have that same kind of that feisty heroine spark that we're so accustomed to and that we just mm-hmm. automatically root for. She's definitely not there yet, and sometimes it's hard to imagine that she is our main character.
Yeah, I find her, is she like sickly or something? Like she can't like walk very far, and like her only way to get exercise is by riding.
Yeah. Yeah, and at some point, it just sounds like she has a headache because she's just supremely dehydrated, and Edmund fixes that by giving her wine.
Yeah.
It's like, that's not gonna, never mind, she'll sleep, it's totally cool.
She feels to me sort of like Cinderella a little bit. I don't think she's as put down, maybe, like, she doesn't have to live in like, the attic or whatever, but she's clearly used by everybody in order to, like, do all their chores, and people don't seem to care much about her. They forget her. So I was definitely sort of getting those Cinderella vibes from her. But again, Cinderella is, like, a little bit more assertive than Fanny.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think part of it is because we are reading it, like, only 5 chapters at a time that maybe we don't get, like, get to see a nice, gentle arc, or it's like too gentle right now. It's so clear that she is being set up as our main person.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's something we need to like investigate further in ourselves of like, why is this person who just seems mm-hmm. so meek and not equipped, not well equipped yet to defend herself and needs Edmund to do it for her? Why she's not someone that we're quite so sympathetic with?
I mean, she is sympathetic. Like, I feel bad for her. Like, it stinks that she, like, isn't invited places. It's hard to watch her just be, like, forgotten by Edmund, even. I found this scene with the horse really, really upsetting. How, mm-hmm. you know, Edmund goes to all this trouble to get her a horse so she can exercise, which is wonderful. And we, like, went on raptures last episode about how lovely that was and how thoughtful. But now we have Mary showing up, and Mary gets to use Fanny's horse and takes it for, like, long rides all day. So Fanny is left waiting. And there's a moment that really bothered me when Mary finally brings the horse back. And even the groom who, like, takes Fanny out says something like, oh, Mary's such a good horseback rider. It's funny because, like, she's so much better at it than you were when we taught you.
Like anyone.
Yeah, it's just so mean.
I mean, I think, like, part of it, especially for like romantic stories, there's a desire to want to relate to the main character. And often it is someone who's like kind of messy and you're like, oh, that's me, but then she has all these amazing positive qualities that I want to identify with or be able to identify with. But if you identify with Fanny, you kind of have to admit that like all these less savory, less strong appearing things, you have to claim them to, I don't know.
I mean, to be unfair sort of to Fanny, I think we are supposed to look at her in juxtaposition with Mary Crawford, because Mary is, you know, everyone keeps telling us how pretty she is. Mm-hmm. Everyone, you know, she plays her harp like so well. Like everyone is just constantly talking about how strong she is, how good at horseback riding she is. Even a young woman, pretty lively with a harp as elegant herself, both placed near a window, was nearly enough to catch any man's heart. Like we're told over and over again how much different and how much better Mary Crawford is. And it seems like it's sort of two versions of femininity. There's Mary, the strong, vivacious, beautiful woman who can get along with everyone and everything. And then you have Fanny, who bends over backwards to be pleasing to everyone and ends up pleasing sort of not herself. And she can't do all the things that Mary does. I think we're supposed to view Fanny, because she's the protagonist, is not better, but we're supposed to be upset when Mary does sort of thoughtless things and we're supposed to judge her. There's that scene where she talks about how bad her brother is at writing letters. And then Fanny's like, well, my brother writes me really good letters. Like, what are you talking about? Like, it, just because your brother sucks at writing doesn't mean that, like, all brothers are bad at writing letters. But even because I get so annoyed with Fanny, I'm like, yeah, Mary is, like, more interesting. Like, I like Mary better. Like, why isn't this book about Mary? But the book isn't about Mary, mostly. It's about Fanny.
Which is kind of interesting to think about. Again, we've addressed this before, you know, Austin gets a lot of critique of, like, oh, all the main characters are the same. They're just these kind of headstrong women who are, like, ahead of their time. But instead of focusing on Mary Crawford, who admittedly, more practically, was keeping her eye on Tom, but is now actually like finding Edmund to be a really pleasant person who's like, there's just something about his manners, way that she actually seems to enjoy being around. That seems like a shoo-in for your Austin main female character. But instead, Austin is focusing her attention on someone who literally, like, everyone else in this book seems to just forget is there, except when they try to keep her out of everything. Mm. That is actually, like, really interesting that on her third book, this is what she wants to do with her attention and with her story.
Oh, yeah, I like that. Sort of a flipping on its head of her previous works that we discussed. I do think I do see shades of Eleanor in her. Like, there was a lot of moments when we were reading Sense and Sensibility where we were both frustrated with Eleanor because she was very passive when it came to Edward. But at the same time, I find Fanny to be even more frustrating than Eleanor because Edmund is right there. I mean, part of it might be denial. Like, I think that Fanny doesn't know whether to think of Edmund as her brother or as a potential love interest. And she's clearly, at least subconsciously, jealous of Mary Crawford and Edmund's interest in her, but she hasn't articulated that to herself. So if you're not honest with yourself, how can you really come across as someone that's willing to try, I guess?
I mean, this whole time she's been growing up in this household where they've tried to make it very clear, you are here, we care about you because you're family, but also you're not family, you're not an equal, you're a lower person, you're not really one of us. And, you know, they stated very early on that they were going to make sure that that delineation was super clear. So I imagine she's internalized a lot of that and thought, well, I don't deserve it, even if I do want it. When Edmund asks to borrow the mare that is technically his anyways to teach Mary, there was a part where Fanny was just like, I mean, like, it's not great, but oh my God, I'm so grateful. It is so kind of him to have even asked. That's just amazing. It's so kind. I was like, oh girl, your bar is on the floor. That is so low.
That's a really good point. I think I do think I am judging her based on more of my modern sensibilities than really recognizing the way that she was brought up. I really hate the scene where Edmund comes back after like being out all day and Mrs. Norris and Miss Bertram are just like chilling on the sofa and Edmund's like, where's Fanny? And Mrs. Norris is like, oh, I don't know where she is. And then Fanny's like, oh, I'm here. And she's like in the other side of the room. And Mrs. Norris is like, ugh, like, what are you doing? Like yells at her. And Fanny's like not feeling well because she spent all day doing their chores. And it's such a upsetting scene because you want Fanny to be sitting with them and be like, oh, hi, Edmund, like, come over and talk to me. But mm-hmm. that's just not who Fanny is, and it's understandable because she just spent this entire day with these awful people that treated her like garbage, and she's not feeling well because of it. So I should mm-hmm. I need to work on pausing and being like, yes, I'm annoyed, but Fanny's probably annoyed with herself too because she can't stand up for herself. But why would she? These people took her in and took care of her. So I get it.
Yeah, it's one of those things where you're like, oh, they did the bare minimum for you. Oh, cool, cool, mm-hmm. cool, cool. Julia and Mariah, the Bertram sisters, aren't exactly known for their kindness to her either. But in that moment, even Julia was just like, look, Fanny isn't the kind to just lay about in the sofa and do nothing any more than anyone else who lives here. And in that moment, I think that was the moment where even I had to, like, recognize my own attitudes to her mm-hmm. of how much harder it is for her, and see that the Bertram, Lady Bertram and Mrs. Norris, who are being portrayed as our just apathetic or just unkind aunties anyways, that it's kind of like ableist the way they talk about her and blame her for just being so weak and so lethargic and everything, when she doesn't even go out to exercise, which also wasn't her fault because her one, like, mode of exercise was being taken away from her because of Edmund.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a really good point. Yeah. That's why I think I have to take this book a little bit. Like, on first read, I need to read it first and be like, okay, this is how I'm feeling. Because I do think it's valid to be annoyed with Fanny. But then to, like, go back and sort of interrogate why. Mm-hmm. Like, why am I annoyed with her? Like, why is she reacting like this? Because you're right, she's just so, she wants to please everyone. She's so shy and quiet and reserved, and, like, she can't speak up for herself. And and she's dealing with these people that are just constantly belittling her, and how growing up in a situation like that would make anyone, especially someone who starts off really shy, just feel like trash all the time. So I'm glad we talked about this, because I was very nervous with Fanny.
It's so hard. Just and I speak of as a recovering people pleaser myself, and someone who's had to deal with my own self-esteem issues and had to learn how to speak up for myself as well. It's hard to reconcile yourself, like, now with who you were back then, and having to remember all the work and time and failures that it takes to get to that point where you are able to speak up, especially when she's had someone like Edmund who was there for her and who spoke up for her. It's so easy to rely on that person.
That's a good point. She relies on Edmund.
She really does. And then with Mary, like, threatening to take it away, like, no wonder she's just like, oh, no. Mm-hmm. Oh, no. Oh, no, 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 no. It did remind me of last time when you told me about a quote from the introduction of your edition, where it referred to Mansfield Park's problematic status and how it is, like, it has long been agreed that this is Austen's most complex and profound and her least likable novel. This mm-hmm. section definitely made me realize, I see why.
Yeah.
I think I'm getting why. It is incredibly complex. There's so many shades of gray, and more than just playing around with the certain types that she set in her previous books that we've gotten so accustomed to. And sometimes it's kind of uncomfortable.
Yeah, and there's stuff that I think we as modern readers, and modern maybe American readers, I don't know, like, who just probably wouldn't get. Because I think that Mary and Henry are supposed to represent the city. They're supposed to represent London and modernity. And Fanny and Edmund are supposed to represent tradition and the way that things are. You know, like, Mary comes to town and says, you know, in London, I would be able to get my harp. And Edmund's like, well, it's harvest season. Like, everyone's really busy. And she just doesn't understand that, like, why things can't be done the way that they're done in London. And there's a lot of moments where just Mary and Henry a little bit are really clueless as to, like, quote unquote, country life and how mm-hmm. things happen here versus in London. And a lot of these things I don't think we would get on first read without that context. While as a reader in Austen's time would immediately be like, what do all these people think coming in wanting to modernize this other estate? You know, the state is as good as it is now. And you get that discourse, you know, when they're talking about all the changes and all the ways that Mr. Rushford wants to change his estate. Fanny thinks to herself, you know, like, it sounds like it would be good without all these changes. And Edmund thinks sort of similarly. But everyone else is really excited about all these changes that he wants to make. So I think that those are subtle things that we as a reader wouldn't necessarily get at first. And another reason why maybe Mary is not the protagonist we're looking for.
Oh, yeah. No, because there are moments when Mary, you know, not, she says something like, not like super scandalous, but definitely enough to have Edmund and Fanny clutch their pearls a bit. I don't love it for them. I just think it is really interesting that our two supposed like main ship are more pious, real, you know, and more attached to more traditional values, I guess we should say,
mm-hmm.
Especially one that we've seen clergymen in past books be treated not super well or portrayed to be more hypocritical. And then like our main female protagonist is also more traditional and attached to the future clergyman.
Mm-hmm.
While you have Mary, who's just this like, you know, puns about butts.
Something that I saw in like some of the discussion reading that I was doing around this book says that in this sort of time that Austen was writing, country states, estates were, they used to be sort of benevolent, if authoritarian, centers of agrarian society. And then they sort of were, they became showy hunting parks for the wealthy to just like have a house in the country and say that they had a house in the country. So this is clearly something that Austen is irritated about, or at least wants to highlight. And she's using this book to do it and to highlight that. And I just don't think I would have gotten that if I hadn't read someone else pointing it out. But then now knowing that, when I go back and look at the discourse surrounding the improvements that Mr. Rushford wants to make, as well as when they take the tour of his estate, it makes a ton more difference.
Mm. Yeah. Henry really sounds like that kind of person
mm-hmm.
that she has a bit of a problem with, actually.
Yeah, and it's a really interesting way to make that commentary by putting Mary and Henry into her book the way that she does.
Mm-hmm. Whew, okay. Oh my god, we haven't even like really dug into the story yet. Okay. I love that there's so much to this. Mm-hmm. It is just sometimes...
It's overwhelming.
It's very overwhelming because I, you know, I like to mark my progress along the books. And in the past, we've done like every five chapters or so for sections of discussion. But we're a fourth of the way through the book now.
Oh, my gosh. We are?
We are. We are. I marked me in at 24% of the way through. The chapters are so long. So much happens. So, oh, God.
I have way less quotes that I underlined for these chapters than I usually do. I will say that. So even though the chapters are really long, so much of it is so dense that in terms of like witticisms and things that I found entertaining or sort of summarizing points that I wanted to make, I found way less this time around than I have ever while reading.
I know. You want to try doing by characters this time instead of chapters?
Oh, yeah. Let's try that. Let's see. Because I think I do think the relationships are coming together. We are starting to see the literal love triangles, sort of.
Mm-hmm.
That
so many of them. There's like, what, yeah. Three or four now?
Mm-hmm.
Mrs. Norris is slightly less amusing than she used to be. She's just sort of terrible and annoying. And so is Lady Bertram,
yeah.
Who is the picture of apathy. But Mrs. Norris, ugh. She's definitely like heading into like narcissist, evil stepmother territory that I'm not liking.
Yeah, I thought she would be more like funny, and she is sort of funny, but it's much more mean and malevolent.
Malvolio.
I had like two cups of coffee today too. Then I thought when we first started, I was like, oh, she's just like a funny, mean person. But now she's like a really mean, funny person.
It escalated quickly. Yeah, because like at first, you know, as we discussed, she's yelling at Fanny for, you know, being on the sofa, despite the fact that she did the most work that day and had a headache that Edmund was very aware of. And she tried really, really hard to make sure that she wouldn't be invited to Southerton Court along with the others, and how, you know, Lady Bertram would definitely need her.
And then at the end, she like takes up all the room in the carriage with all this like crap that she wants to bring home.
All her gifts that she had just had to talk about. And then insists that like, oh, Fanny, aren't you so grateful that we... you know, endeavor to make you come. I specifically wanted you to come on this trip. Ugh.
Yeah, no, I'm not a fan. I mean, mm-mm. I guess I still, like, her dialogue is maybe the stuff that I consistently highlight the most.
Yeah.
But, yeah, we'll be watching her.
I especially want to keep an eye on her and Dr. Grant because they were funny. Not in, like, a nice way. I really enjoyed that, there was more, who was it? Dr. Grant and Mrs. Norris were seldom good friends, their acquaintances had begun in dilapidations, their habits were totally dissimilar. Because, you know, Miss Norris is going on and on about how, like, oh, she's always got excuses for why she doesn't actually do a thing that she says that everyone else should do. So her not, like, growing more things on her on the parsonage was obviously because she had to dote and spend all her time on her unwell husband. But, oh, it's okay. They got in this, like, amazing Moor Park apricot tree. And Dr. Grant's just like, eh, it's okay.
She reminded me sort of Lady Catherine. Like, remember in Pride and Prejudice, she's like, I'd be really good at piano if I ever studied it. Like, okay. Yeah. That seems a lot like, I would have a beautiful garden if I was, like, able to.
Yeah, she'd be just so amazing. So, Mrs. Norris, downgrade. Dr. Grant, kind of interested.
Yeah, he has a very, just like when he pops in with, like, a dry remark, I appreciate him. And then he, like, goes back into hiding.
Who is the, oh gosh, I'm so bad at names, and everyone's going to find that out now.
I mean, everyone has the same name.
From Sense and Sensibility, the husband who's very, very droll.
Yes, oh my god, I was thinking about him and I totally forgot his name also, so now I'm
like, moving. Maybe we're going to discover he's actually like a really lovely person when he's around good people and he's comfortable at home. Yeah, Hugh Laurie, it was Hugh Laurie.
Yeah, Hugh Laurie. Mr. Palmer.
Mr. Palmer, yes.
Yes, and remember we were like, oh, what a dick. And then at the end we're like, oh, he's actually like a really nice guy, but he's just sarcastic.
Yeah, he just doesn't like being away from home, and I couldn't fault him on that one. So I think it's a little passive-aggressive, but I feel like Dr. Grant is slowly fighting the narcissism.
I'm going to have to like keep an eye out for him, because I definitely just like read over his stuff in these chapters.
And then you've got Mrs. Grant, who just seems like a really lovely person, but she knows her husband, and she's like, at the same time, we've got to keep the peace. So, like, she knows how to play someone like Mrs. Norris and also get her ways. So far, we've got our side couple that we enjoy, like our Mr. and Mrs. Gardner.
Okay. They're not quite on Gardner level for me yet, but I'm going to keep an eye out.
I really, you know, there's potential. We may not see full-on conflict between Dr. Grant and Mrs. Norris, but maybe.
I'm going to headcanon it, so.
And who else we've got? We've got, oh, how about the Rushworths?
Okay, so we don't get, like, a lot of Mr. Rushworth here. We know that he's super boring, but very rich. And I think we sort of feel bad for him here. I mean, at least Fanny does. You know, he's, like, going on and on about his, like, beautiful estate. And then he just gets ditched continually by the woman that he's engaged to.
Yeah, she only ever seems to have energy to give him when she's had, like, a positive interaction with Crawford. Which is terrible. I mean, they actually say at some point that when they first meet Rushworth, when he comes in, his principal business seemed to be to hear the others and who scarcely risked an original thought of his own, which is something I think we got a sense of in the first chunk of chapters when he's like, yeah, I guess, you know what? I'm in love and my mom wants me to get married. So he's maybe not the most confident of people, or maybe not the most certain of his own opinions, or he has prioritized what other people think of him instead. And he just kind of seems like a bit of a stooge or something. Then at the end, when he comes back with the key that he like raced to get, you're like, oh, you're not completely unaware. You see what's going on, don't you?
I do sort of feel bad for him in that moment when he like sits on the bench or whatever with Fanny and he's like clearly miserable. I think Marie is playing with fire a little bit. Like, yes, they are engaged, but the Bertrams really need Mr. Rushworth way more than he needs them. Like, they need the money, like, clearly. And Maria's attachment with Mr. Rushworth is for the money, but they need that. And the more that she's flaunting this flirtation with Henry, who's not at all interested in getting engaged and who has said multiple times to Mary that we've seen that he's just sort of like having fun and playing a game. We need to watch out for Maria because Mr. Rushworth is clearly aware of everything that's happening and they need him.
I mean, I thought at first it would be more coy about how she deals with her sort of obvious attraction to Henry, but it's so blatant when she's even basically scolding Henry for riding up with Julia and flirting with her the whole time. And Henry's like, oh, no, 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 no. It's just your sister is so much easier to entertain. I don't have to try really hard. She's not as interesting. She's a little more simple. I would have much preferred to have ridden with you up there. You would have been more like an interesting, engaging kind of person. And mm-hmm. everyone knows that it's happening. I mean, obviously Fanny sees it because no one sees her. So she's witnessed everything. And Julia is obviously super jealous. And I love the image of her stomping up the path, being like, where are they?
Yeah. Rushford does get my favorite line, though, in this entire chapter is when mm-hmm. he's, like, sitting with Fanny on the bench and he's complaining about Henry. And he goes, handsome. Nobody can call such an undersized man handsome. He's not 5'9".
It's like, wait, that's still taller than me. And I'm not exactly short.
I was going to ask you, like, I'm very bad at heights because I am very short. So, like, how does that, like, rate height-wise? Like, it's, like, tall.
He's probably lying on his Tinder profile a little. He's probably fudging it to 5'11". Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But he's not a wee.
So being tall means you're handsome, though. I mean, I think that's true, though. There are lots of, like, very tall men where I've had to be like, do I find Beto O'Rourke handsome because he's handsome or because he's tall? Like, I've thought about it.
Is his face too far away for me to, like, really judge accurately?
Yeah, he's just, like, really tall, and I'm attracted to that. But, like, is he handsome? I don't know. I still don't know. Does it matter? He's tall.
It's the age-old question that apparently has been around for a while and will probably plague us for many years to come. Poor Mr. Rushworth. But he also doesn't really do anything about it. So, I don't know.
He just, like, complains.
Yeah. Oh, there was also a really funny moment when they were in the chapel, when they were touring the house, and Julia's trying so hard of, like, wow, Henry, don't Mr. Rushworth, and Maria looks so good on that altar together.
So not subtle.
I mean, they look like they're about to get married right now. Too bad we don't have a license so that they can get married this very second. Oh, if only Edmund was currently a clergyman and he could just marry him right on the spot, because look at that perfect cup. So good. It's so good. It just clearly belonged together.
Everyone is upset with her in that moment. Like, literally everyone.
Julia might actually, for as bad as I feel about her, she might be my favorite character.
Yeah, she's, like, one of the, like, evil stepsisters, but, like, the one that's, like, not super evil, just, like, ignorant evil, you know?
The one who's Melanie Lynskey in Ever After.
Perfect. Nailed it.
Actually, that's great casting. Let's stick with that one.
Perfect.
Oh, gosh. I'm, like, still trying to work my way down the hierarchy. Or up the hierarchy.
Well, some people have, like, overlapping stuff. Like, so we talked about Mr. Rushworth, so maybe we talk about...
Mrs. Rushworth.
Oh, Mrs. Rushworth.
She seems nice. That's all I have to say about it. She seems nice.
She seems nice. Yeah, she likes talking about her house.
Yeah, she knows it as well as the housekeeper. Mm-hmm. And she wants to be the one to show everyone everything. And she just seems, like, real nice. She was probably too involved with her son, but okay.
Yeah, that's a pretty good summary. Well, I was thinking Maria, because... we already sort of talked about her dynamic with Mr. Rushworth.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, she feels something very passionate going on to risk it, because she seemed pretty content with, like, I guess I'll just marry this guy who thinks he loves me and has money.
Yeah, there's a sense of, like, when they go to this house to tour, there's a sense of that they are sort of, like, play acting. That, like, this isn't quote-unquote real. And mm-hmm. you, like, the love triangles are very clearly delineated. You have Edmund, Mary, and Fanny, and they go off on their own into the estate. And then you have Henry, Mr. Rushworth, and Maria, and to a lesser extent Julia, that go off. And so you have the two different sources of relationship conflict. And I read this really good analysis of the park, because I was like, why are we getting all this explanation? And it says that the park at Southerton represents the attempts of man to control nature over the centuries. It even includes an artificial, quote, wilderness area that's supposed to look wild and natural, but in reality, it's actually carefully groomed. And the action that takes place in that park is really reliant on the setting, because people might think that the park and the wilderness are a place where social normal rules might not apply. But at the same time, it's a place that's not really wild. It's made by human hands. So actually, rules do apply. So Maria might think that she's flouting, like, she can do whatever she wants. She can flirt with this man even though she's engaged. But actually, she can't. There are consequences to her actions here.
I think it's safe to say she's the one who's hardest to sympathize for. because she's making these choices. And I mean, I know I should feel worse, bad for her, because she's obviously stuck in this construct where she has to marry. That's where her worth lies. That's her only purpose. That's what she was raised to do and to believe. And now she's actually feeling something that might be real, at least on her end. Mm-hmm. And she's never exactly been taught of like how, you know, learn about that self kind of self-control and the consideration of other people. But she's like really screwing over her sister. She's potentially screwing over herself. She's screwing over this man who believes that he loves her. And it's really reckless in a way that just makes me cringe the whole time.
Yeah, the same discussion I was reading said that them, like Henry and Maria breaking through the gate without the key is a metaphor for sex. Because it's like a locked space that they're penetrating.
Yeah, oh gosh.
I'm sorry.
No, that, because afterwards Fanny is like trying to warn her, you know, you will hurt yourself, Miss Bertram, she cried. You will certainly hurt yourself against the spikes. You will tear your gown. You will be in danger of slipping into the haha. You had better not go. And I'm like, they're definitely not talking about the gate now.
I know. Well, it's funny even more when you think about the rules that are set aside in Bridgerton mm-hmm. that we were talking about. Like, even being alone with a man can ruin you. If people see you out in the garden with a man, that's it. You're ruined. You have to marry that man or you have to leave. And then you have Mary and Edmund going off to, like, wherever. And then you have Maria and Henry going off, like, wherever by themselves. I mean, they don't have chaperones here, so, like, maybe it doesn't matter. But it just seems sort of interesting that the rules are different in London society versus like mm-hmm. this wild country estate.
I just kept seeing these couples go off and I'm like, no, they're going on the dark walk. What will people say? Mrs. Norris had configured everything so that she would keep the other grown-ups busy so that her nieces could like have a nice time. But yeah, it's so confusing. And it pits, I think, Fanny against these two women who are trying to live their lives, basically. And she's such a more conservative, more pious person who's almost afraid of breaking with these traditional norms about what's proper and everything. And then on top of that, her beloved Edmund, who has agreed with her about so many things, including the piousness and propriety, going off with one of them.
No, it's a really interesting scene, and it took me a little bit to unpack exactly like what was happening and why mm-hmm. like Fanny just like keeps getting abandoned, and then people keep showing up and like telling them her secrets or telling her their secrets and then like leaving.
I mean, I guess it sort of harkens back to last time we were talking about the classicism against someone like Fanny, who comes from like much lower means than the other two, than her cousins and her mother's sisters. Even though they are all from the same place and they're just acting like they're different because they marry different people. And how, because she is seen as lower class, they almost ignore her the way that we almost never address the servants in the Austen story. She's one of the people that just kind of blends in with that servant class. So she knows all the stuff. She sees all the things. Mm-hmm. But because she's sort of family, she almost gets invested in a way where she can feel more abandoned than the others. On top of that, she is the more pious person on top of everything else. Mm-hmm. It's so much to unpack. My God. But I did love that after all these, you know, couples going on and all this like almost tension happening with people just going off with people they're not supposed to, alone, unchaperoned, Julia stomps in.
Oh, Julia.
Coming down the path at a quick pace. And I imagine like leaves in her hair for some reason, or like a little bit of dirt at the hem of her gown, with her face just red and just like, where are they?
Poor Julia, the only one of the nine not terribly satisfied with their lot, was now in a state of complete penance and as different from the Julia of the brooch box as could well be imagined. Because remember, Julia got to ride with Henry on the way there.
Yeah, she thought she had something there. Yeah, and then I like this moment when Rushworth came back and Fanny kind of basically convinces him that like, no, it's probably fine. They were waiting for you just past that grassy knoll over there. You should go after them. And she's not trying to like keep him around. And there's a line that said she found herself more successful in sending away than in retaining a companion. So it was just like, well, I may as well just send this one away too.
Oh, I love that line. I was like, it's sort of a sad self-burn. Mm-hmm. I think I have it as.
It is like a small hint of like, oh, actually Fanny does have some humor and sass and awareness in her, so maybe that's why that's there, other than just to make us readers amused.
I'm gonna I like that reading. I'm gonna go for it.
Yeah. All right. And then we also have, I think, a so much more interesting, complex, nuanced update on the Caroline Bingley.
Mary Crawford or
Mary Crawford.
Mary Crawford. Well, Mary Crawford's like beautiful.
She's beautiful. So she's... Even Fanny herself says, where is this name? When Edmund is asking what he thinks about her. Fanny says, I like to hear her talk. She entertains me and she's so extremely pretty that I have great pleasure in looking at her. And I'm like, well, Fanny, okay.
Oh, Fanny.
That was a fun conversation because a little twisting the knife in the heart a little bit because Edward has these misgivings, this like tiniest of red flags about the way Mary talked about her. But at the same time, he just seems to be looking for Fanny to validate, like, no, she's awesome and great and you should super fall in love with her.
Yeah, it's a really interesting way that it unfolds because he does sort of dig for some flaws. Like, he tries to get Fanny to say, you know, what do you think of her? You know, like, but was there nothing in her conversation that struck you, Fanny, as not quite right? And so Fanny sort of brings up, like, a couple points that he, like, agrees with. And then he, quote, for he was in line of admiration of Miss Crawford, which might lead him where Fanny could not follow. So then he just sort of goes off and, like, has the hots for her, and Fanny loses him a bit, and he's falling in love with her, and it's really sad.
But I also get why Edmund likes Mary.
Yeah, I mean, she sounds great. I would probably, like, love Mary, too. I would either hate her or love her.
Yeah, that's super fair. Because I feel like I've had this conversation before with friends who are like, oh, I mean, he's not very nice to dogs, but he's, like, super hot and super nice and has this great job and he pays for my dinner and that kind of thing. And you're like, wait, can we rewind a little bit to the part where, like, it seems like a small thing, but it also seems like it could be a red flag.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, no, but it's fine because we get along so cool and everything. It's like Edmund is aware of this part of him. His, like, intuition is telling him something, but at the same time, he wants to ignore it because he's just super into this girl.
Yeah, Fanny's remarks that she's surprised by it. She says she was a little surprised that he could spend so many hours with Miss Crawford and not see more of the sort of fault which he had already observed, and of which she was already almost always reminded by something of the same nature whenever she was in her company. So it's like sort of a nice way to say, like, Edmund, you didn't like all these other stuff about her, and she keeps, like, reinforcing it. Like, it wasn't a one-off thing. Like, she has so-and-so issues that you already know. But Fanny also isn't a man blinded by, like, a pretty woman, so
because apparently she's just that
hot,
gorgeous. And there's sometimes when, like, she's even more aware of the fact that of things than Edmund, like when she recognized or acknowledged that she was borrowing the horse, like, too much, knowing that she was keeping it a little too long. And maybe that was manipulative of just, like, appearing really nice and everything and thoughtful. But, she said it even before Edmund did. Like, I'm really sorry. That was me. I was enjoying myself too much. I know this is your horse. But still, yeah.
She does get one of my favorite lines. She goes, nothing ever fatigues me but doing what I do not like. I love it. It's so great.
Yeah, no, she's fun. And the thing that Edmund and Fanny seem to have held against Miss Crawford in the conversation when he was talking to Fanny was when Miss Crawford made, like, that side comment about Rears and Vices and her uncle, and they're like, that was sort of an improper thing to say, wasn't it? And in another context, she definitely would be our main character because she's just, like, the one throwing out the side jokes that maybe was something scandalous, maybe it wasn't. Again, butts and sin.
Yeah, there's that scene where they're walking through the estate, and we're told, like, over and over again how boring Mr. Rushworth is, and there's, like, a juxtaposition directly drawn between Fanny and Miss Crawford, and it says, Miss Crawford, who had seen scores of great houses and cared for none of them, had only the appearance of civilly listening, while Fanny, to whom everything was almost as interesting as it was new, attended with unaffected earnestness to all that Mrs. Rushworth could relate of the family. So on first glance, you're like, wow, Fanny's so lovely. She's, like, so attentive and listening and cares about all this stuff about the house. But if I were Miss Crawford and I had toured, like, 1,000 estates, I would probably be bored of this, like, country one too. Mm-hmm. I feel like it's a really, like, of course she's bored. Like, it's supposed to draw a contrast between, like, Fanny being this lovely, interested person and Miss Crawford being bored and jaded. But at the same time, when you think about it, like, it's sort of super relatable that Miss Crawford would just be like nicely pretending to listen and not really care at all.
Yeah. And I think at some point it comes across like, oh, she's just like a big snobby lady. But mm-hmm. like you said, it seems completely normal that she's like, she's seen a bunch of these houses. So, you know, it's totally fine. Or when she goes on and on about like the harp, like you mentioned earlier, that she couldn't understand, but she's like, oh my God, I was just actually like really boorish and am, you know, and an inconvenience to everyone asking for this harp when I just honestly didn't know that people were going to be busy doing other stuff because of the time of year and where we live and everyone has all these other things that they absolutely have to be doing right now.
I really do sort of enjoy Mary, but there is a point when they're touring the little chapel where she makes all those comments about being a clergyman mm-hmm. without knowing that Edmund's about to be one that feels a little rough.
Mm-hmm. I think that's another like comparison of like someone who's like quote unquote more worldly, so they're not as attached to ideas of the church. And she seems to be genuinely maybe penitent is like the wrong word to be using in this context, but she does seem to be penitent to have like gone on and on about it when she finds out like, oh, actually, you know, the guy I'm interested in, he wants that. And she doesn't super get it, but she's like actually nicer about it. And it's a whole like, well, I guess we agree to disagree. But she actually says, you really are fit for something better. Come, do change your mind. It's not too late. Go into the law, which made me think of you, of course.
I know. I like all those lines. Like, oh, yeah, here we go.
It's a nobler profession, Jesse.
Yes, it's also the wilderness, Annie.
It's sort of fascinating because she's trying not to offend him on this thing that was important to him, but also it's not important to her. So
yeah, she doubles down, I think, on being like, instead of like, she apologizes, like, if I had known before, I would have spoken above the cloth with more respect. But then she says immediately after, a clergyman is nothing. And you do get the sense that she's like, don't be a clergyman, like be a lawyer, because like that's way more respectable. That's more what if I can see like a potential husband. And Edmund just calmly is like, this is really important to me. I think it's important to my town. Like, I want to be a good man. And it does sort of turn into flirting, and it clearly isn't enough to piss off Edmund enough that he doesn't like take her into the wood together. But it's a really telling moment because Fanny, this is like the most emotion we get from Fanny so far in the book, is after Miss Mary says all this stuff, it says Fanny colored and looked at Edmund but felt too angry for speech. Fanny is like felt too angry. Like, that's like the first real emotion that I feel like we've gotten from her other than like sadness.
But like, maybe that's what Edmund likes, someone who gives him something to not fight against, just to like actually have to be more certain and know what he wants in order to be able to defend it, someone who keeps him on his toes. Because again, it's so easy to be with someone where you agree with everything on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then immediately she like reaches out to touch his arm and he's like all excited about it. And he's like, let's go for a walk in the woods. So it doesn't like seem to bother him that much.
Yeah. And even later on, he's just like, eh, I mean, she can't really be serious about these things. It's fine. It's probably not a big deal. She doesn't know these things anyways, which is incredibly condescending. Edmund.
Yes. Edmund. But it is sort of a red flag to us as the viewer. Like, okay, Mary isn't really meant to be with Edmund. Mm-hmm. So we should like keep a watch on it. But at the same time, I sort of refuse to maybe see Mary as quote unquote evil or as maybe the book wants me to.
Mm-hmm. Because I mean, at no point I didn't pick up on any point where they showed her liking him because he's, you know, going to be, he's the second son of a lord. Because that's kind of why she was like interested in Tom, because he was like charismatic adventurer, gambler, whatever. She seems to be interested in Edmund because despite their differences there is, and despite the fact that he's not this amazing, exciting figure, there is something about him that's just unquestionably good and attentive and sincere, I think was one of the words that they used. And I respect that. I really like that she likes that about him.
I do too, but I will say there is a line where she says, and you know there's generally an uncle or grandfather to leave a fortune to the second son. So she's like not making totally Machiavellian, unthoughtful decisions on who she wants to be with. But I also think that the context of the time, like you were saying, is really important because, yeah, that does seem really sneaky of her, but she has to look out for herself because she's a woman in this time that she can't really do anything to provide for herself. So she does need a man who can. So even that is understandable in the context. So I just convinced myself to double down on agreeing with you.
Yeah. She's got good game. And I also really like that moment when he pulls out his watch and she goes, oh, do not attack me with your watch. A watch is always too fast or too slow. I cannot be dictated by watch. And it was a highly relatable statement as someone who has a very tenuous relationship with time.
Oh, I like that.
You can't make me like Mary, too.
I know. Yeah, I like her much better than sort of Miss Bingley, and I think you're right in that she's the Miss Bingley of this book, but I immediately like her better than I liked Miss Bingley, so I'm sorry, Miss Bingley, but...
Yeah, no, Miss Bingley was a little too desperate and a little too malicious? Yeah, let's say malicious. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think we mostly talked about Edmund in the context of other people, but is there anything you want to, like, add particularly about him?
There's some times when I just we got up to the point where I was starting not to like Edmund because he was so forgetful and neglectful when it came to Fanny, someone he had like taken on this responsibility towards her, an obligation, but I also couldn't blame him. And then the story would like bring him back around to be like, no, he remembered himself and to be a kind and thoughtful person, despite, you know, trying to give into things that he wanted. And ignoring the differences.
Yeah. I want to give him grace as like a young man and who's attracted to this pretty woman and becomes distracted by her to the extent that he forgets about the things that are important to him but then remembers. But at the same time, it's very frustrating in Fanny's POV to see how sad she is when Edmund forgets her. And the horse scene is really upsetting to read, as well as the scene of her just sitting there on the bench while they like go off without her, and them just constantly being, Fanny's too weak, Fanny's not strong enough, this other woman's strong, and Fanny thinks like, I wish I was strong like they were. It's really interesting to go back to what you were saying about the ableist comments that they're making about Fanny, and it makes me wonder, you know, what all the talking about her being strong enough, and yeah, it's really sad. Mm-hmm. But I am willing to understand that Edmund thinks he's in love, and there's a pretty woman, and
they get on, and he gets to teach her how to ride, and all this stuff.
He's fallen under her spell.
Yeah, I feel it necessary also to point out that he may have been the very first person that at least I was able to find to refer to throwing a shade or throwing shade on someone.
Oh my gosh, wait, where? Where do you see
in that? Chapter 7 when he's talking to Fanny, when he's asking her, like, was there anything weird about that conversation? And they both agree that she shouldn't have spoken about her uncle as such. And Fanny starts calling her, like, ungrateful. And Edmund's like, nah, that's too strong a word. And he says, with such warm feelings and lively spirits, it must be difficult to do justice to her affection for Mrs. Crawford without throwing a shade on the Admiral. So, of course, I had to look this up.
Yes, no, tell me.
It was kind of hard to find anything really definitive because a lot of what I found was accrediting the phrase of throwing shade used in a slang capacity to the gay community, particularly the Black and Latino. Hold on, let me actually find it. The slang version of throwing shade originated from the Black and Latino gay communities, particularly in 1980s in New York City, especially in the working class ethnic groups and in the ballroom and vogue culture, particularly by nonconformists. But so I obviously don't want to take that away from them. I am not a linguistic historian by any means. I couldn't really find too much, and I admit I didn't dig as hard as I probably could have either because I'm a terrible person. But I like to think that in between, you know, living their most amazing best lives ever and in fighting for civil rights and fair treatment as humans of worth, that these people of these community were also reading Jane Austen in their downtime.
That works for me. I like that a lot. I don't know, maybe it's a coincidence, but if it is, it's a very funny one.
I really love it, and I hope that somehow the two are connected. So, well done, Edmund.
Throwing shade.
Yeah, don't throw shade on the Admiral. And I feel like we've circled around talking about Fanny this whole time in context of other characters. And honestly, it just feels like most of the time she is just there in the context of other characters. She's not quite the main character of her own life story yet.
Yeah, that's a really good way of putting it. I think we are seeing the dominoes begin to fall into place. We see that there's clearly going to be some tension romantically between Mary Crawford, Edmund, and Fanny. But I don't think Fanny herself really doesn't know yet that she has feelings for Edmund. We as the reader can infer them. And maybe Edmund even does have feelings sort of for Fanny that he can't name, and he's using Mary to make her jealous. I don't know. I don't really read that in Edmund's character, but I wouldn't be surprised either. So I think that that's the conflict, that the main conflict, because Fanny's our main character. Whereas I think the Rushforth and Miss Bertram love triangle is also there, but more in the background, maybe more as like comic relief or to inform the main love triangle with Fanny.
My hope is, I anticipate that Fanny will be able to take more of the center stage in her own story, unless things really get turned around and expectations are subverted that much. But until then, it's a little bit of a struggle there.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree.
Okay, but I am looking forward to seeing where we go from here.
I know. Now that we sort of have a better sense about the romantic pairings and a better sense of all the players, hopefully the plot will start to take off with less describing or catching up, I guess.
It's so many, you know, the cup and ball game, everything getting shuffled around and me trying to keep track of it and my eyes are spinning. But it's really enjoyable in a heart kind of way.
Yeah, you know, when I was reading these chapters, I was like, what are we going to talk about? This is like such a slog. Like, I don't really care about all the changes that need to be made to the estate. But when you actually like dive into it and get into it, I think there's a lot to say. And I like the idea of talking about the characters versus maybe going chapter by chapter. So we clearly have a lot to talk about.
Yeah, which is kind of cool, actually. I tend to be more of a character-based person than a plot person. Mm-hmm. You know, if the characters don't make sense and if their choices don't make sense to who they are, then I tend to check out of a story a lot. So this has been a really interesting change of tone from our previous books.
Yes, and I really like the idea that we're interrogating why Fanny doesn't work for us on first read, and then understanding why maybe that is, and why she's different than other Austen heroines, and why we should not, you know, just like brush her aside as not as worthy as an Elizabeth Bennet or a Marianne. So yeah. I think that you've helped change my mind.
Full agree.
Do you have any burns? I found like it was because it was such like melancholy chapter. I don't have as many as I usually do.
I had a really hard time. There are a few moments of like Mary Crawford saying things that I just like got very eye-rolly about. But on going back to them, I'm like, no, she actually was just like being kind of witty. Like when she apologized to Fanny, before Fanny even said anything about the horse. And she's just like, oh, selfishness must always be forgiven, you know, because there is no hope of a cure. And I was like, oh, that's actually like, that's kind of funny.
I think next to that quote, I had like, bitch, in like capital letters.
When they were talking about William, Fanny's brother, and Mary is kind of being snobby about like the quote unquote inferior ranks, because she's so accustomed to admirals and all that stuff with her uncle and everything who raised her. And Edmund's just like, oh, do you know our cousin's captain or anything? Miss Crawford civilly wished him an early promotion.
I like that.
It's like the nicest thing she could possibly say. It was like, well, I hope he's not so lowly for so long. Mm-hmm. And I actually meant to save the line that she said that inspired Edmund to talk about throwing shade. Certainly my home at my uncle's brought me acquainted with a circle of admirals. Of rears and vices I saw enough. Now do not be suspecting me of a pun I entreat. It's not necessarily a burn, but it is kind of funny because she's talking about rear admirals and vice admirals, but she's also like, I saw a lot of butts and sin.
Very funny. I do have a soft spot for her.
It's hard not to like her.
My favorite burn, I think, is actually Edmund, which is sort of funny. Ooh. And it's in reference to Mary, and it's when they're walking in the woods together and Mary says something like, oh, is it like another mile or something? And Edmund goes, not half a mile, was his sturdy answer, for he was not yet so in love as to measure distance or reckon time with feminine lawlessness. Yeah. Which is like maybe sort of like, oh, these silly females, and like probably super sexist, but at the same time it's just very funny because he's like not in love enough to like not like, it's a man that's more in love would just, like, let it go, but he's not in love enough to just, like, let a stupid comment go. He has to, like, correct her.
He still has to be a little, like, okay.
Yeah. I love it. So I really like it.
I love it. At least you know Edmund isn't completely lost yet.
Yes, yes. It's a very good moment for Edmund, too, so.
So.
Yes.
So much... God only knows we're going to be this exhausted next time, but next time we will be reading chapters 11 through 15. We'll probably have a lot to say. I'm sure you guys out there have a lot to say or worry about or think about or tell us that we're wrong about. Feel free to let us know.
But either way, rate us 5 stars on your preferred platform for downloading up.
Yes, just a little something. Jesse, where can people find us?
Yes, so we'd love to hear from you. Like Annie said, you can find us at thedailynightly.com. You can find us on Twitter at nightlypod, Instagram at thedailynightly, where Annie is just very good with the memes. They're very funny. I love waking up and seeing them. And please, please email us. Our email is thedailynightly@gmail.com. Remember, nightly is spelled K-N-I-G-H-T-L-E-Y.
Yes, and our super fun music at the top and bottom of the episode is by Kevin MacLeod. Thank you very much. Until next time, guys.
Yes, happy reading.